Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the Packaging Brothers podcast. Brandon Frank here. Today's guest is Kimberly Martin with McCormick & Company. She is a global food contact regulatory expert, and we had a lovely conversation, and I think you guys will get a lot out of it. So sorry, I'm not feeling too great. So if my voice is a little off or if I sound a little stuffy, that's why. But here we go. Kim, welcome to the Packaging Brothers podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
No, thanks for being on. So I have to ask, let's just start here. Like, what does a global food contact regulatory expert do?
Yeah, so food contact is kind of a term that I think in packaging, it might be known of, but I think there's a limited understanding of it. So I deal with basically the chemical safety of food packaging. So making sure that all the materials and chemicals and additives used in that food packaging are safe for the intended use and aren't going to transfer anything to the food that's potentially hazardous to consumers.
Okay. So you're basically making sure that the packaging isn't going to hurt anyone because the food and the whatever the packaging is could potentially, what's the word when it uses when like the plastic actually goes into the food?
Migration.
Yeah. Okay. And so how did you get into this? Like, what kind of led you to like want to actually work on this stuff on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even know it existed until I got into it. So I've always been very interested in science. You know, growing up, I always found it very interesting. I originally wanted to be a veterinarian, so I kind of went down that scientific path. I got my bachelor's degree in biology, and then I actually went to graduate school for biochemistry. So I got my master's in biochemistry. I worked in a couple academic research labs. I worked at the University of Chicago for a few years doing protein engineering research. You know, I have some publications from that work, but ultimately it wasn't really what I saw myself doing long term. So through a mutual friend, I found out about a job at a consulting firm. And so I took that. And it was as a project manager, just kind of getting the food contact, food regulatory compliance work kind of started for that group as it was developing. And I absolutely loved it. So I just kept learning more and more about it, started taking on projects myself, and ultimately ended up managing, you know, a team of consultants in food contact compliance for them.
Well, that's great. And so now you're with McCormick & Company.
Yes. So now that I'm on the other side working for a company for their regulatory compliance, it's definitely a lot different. As a consultant, you know, I worked with so many different companies along the supply chain, and there were so many different issues that would come my way, and it was very fast paced and I loved it. But now being on the other side, I find it very interesting as well to see more of the issues as they come up internally and, you know, how we manage those as a company.
That's great. Can you tell us a little bit about McCormick & Company? Like, what do they do?
Yeah. So McCormick & Company, I think most people think of them as spice company, and that is definitely one of our biggest products is our spices, but we're also more of a flavor company, I'd say. So there's a lot of brands that we own that a lot of people don't even know about, like Frank's, Cholula, Zatarain's. So we do have a very wide portfolio of different foods. And so as part of that, the packaging is a critical component of it. So,
well, being a Frank's hot sauce was always one of my favorites. All right. So let's kind of dig into, like, you know, what are some of the kind of the most interesting parts of, you know, kind of testing packaging and food? Maybe what are some of the things that have surprised you the most? Or, you know, we all sit down and I think most people in the packaging industry kind of don't think like this, but people outside, you know, they never really think about the packaging. It's all about the Frank's hot sauce, but not how that's actually engaging with different liners or caps, closures, or the container itself. So
yeah, that's definitely, I think, especially at a lot of food companies, the food is the product, but the packaging is a vital component of that. But I think it is a lot of times overlooked in terms of its importance for the final products. I definitely saw that in my consulting career where the people coming to me from their companies weren't necessarily food contact regulatory people. They were in charge of quality or something else, and it just kind of got put on their table. So it seems like there wasn't a lot of people dedicated to managing the food contact compliance and chemical safety aspect of the packaging.
But when it comes to like different packaging formats, like glass versus plastic, like what are some of the things that you kind of have learned or that you think would be important to know?
Yeah, the different materials, that definitely comes into play, especially with all of the upcoming regulations and everything with, you know, extended producer responsibility and sustainability. I think it's really easy to say, you know, I was just listening to a previous episode about multi-layer packaging, and it is wonderful, but it's not recyclable. And I think on the surface, it's easy to say, okay, just use paper or use something else. But it's not that straightforward. And that's the kind of thing I do now with McCormick is saying, okay, if you're looking at transitioning from a multi-layer plastic to a paper sachet, there's a lot of different chemical concerns that you have to think of. You know, paper is not going to be as much of a barrier from one, the external environment, as well as the chemicals that are used in the packaging itself. So if there's a lot of printing inks on the outside, there's a lot more opportunity for those to migrate inward towards the food and then become an issue. So when you're thinking about the materials, it's definitely, it's not as easy as just swapping them out. There's definitely a lot of pros and cons to all of them. And the chemical concern is definitely one of them.
Yeah, the complexities of different types of packaging and how it actually benefits our life. You know, especially from the crowd, I think that all plastic or all multi-layer plastic, because it's not recyclable, is therefore bad. It's like no, I mean, in a lot of places around the world, food contamination, plastic migration into food is a huge issue.
Yeah, the printing ink specifically, that is a huge issue. One, because I'd say globally, the regulations aren't really developed well enough to manage the safety of printing inks. Printing inks typically have a ton of different things in them. You know, there's the solvents and the pigments, and there's just so much involved in formulating a printing ink that it's hard to regulate that. And the regulations just simply aren't there yet. And then so in terms of, you know, you look at a multi-layer, oftentimes they'll have a layer of aluminum foil. Aluminum foil is a functional barrier. You know, it's kind of one of the go-to default functional barriers in packaging. So anything that's on the other side of the food from that aluminum foil, you don't need to be concerned about migration. Nothing is going to penetrate through and get to the food. So you take that layer away, you know, when you move to something like paper or any other material, then now all of a sudden you have to be concerned about what is in those printing inks that you didn't have to think about before.
All right. So let's just try to get a little bit more maybe simple about this. So like a multi-layer plastic package, maybe have like a specific example that we could like think about, but what are all the different layers in there and what are the functions that they kind of serve? Ideally.
Yeah. So, I mean, they can obviously vary a lot. A lot of them that I see have, you know, just the really thin plastic layers, the tie layers of, you know, kind of like an adhesive or a, sometimes it's more of a resin layer that, you know, just kind of ties those layers together. The aluminum foil is often or sometimes in there. And like I said, that's a great functional barrier. And then you'll typically have some other plastic layers. So it's typically just a bunch of layers of plastic, maybe a layer of aluminum foil. On the outside, you'll have the printing inks and then typically a varnish on top of that to kind of protect it from being scraped off.
Yeah. What kind of special considerations are made with that internal layer that's actually touching the food? Is that different than the other plastic layers at all?
Yeah, I'd say especially in a multi-layer where you can have, you know, different colors and pigments. In the internal layer, it's not as important on, I guess, what it looks like, especially if it's covered by other colored layers. So having it be a more simple formulation is the best way to go, because the way food contact regulations are established is through positive lists. So that plastic that's touching the food and any other layer that has the potential to transfer substances to the food, they have to be manufactured out of substances from that positive list.
Okay. Have you worked at all with like recycled content in flexible packaging, or I guess rigid plastic packaging would be fine too?
Yeah, definitely. And that's, I know that there's a lot of concern there as well, because wherever you're getting that from, who knows what kind of contamination could be in there. So the whole goal with using PCR in food packaging is basically to get it back to the same state as virgin packaging would be. And that can be difficult because you think about the recycling stream, it's not just food packaging being recycled. So, you know, if you're starting with virgin food packaging, it's selected, it's manufactured out of substances from that positive list. It's gone through testing. It's compliant. It's safe for consumers, ideally. You recycle that. That's not a big deal necessarily. But you end up adding all these other plastics that are not food contact grade into the recycling stream. They get recycled. How do you then, you know, make sure you're getting rid of all the contaminants as well as all of the things that were intentionally added to that plastic that aren't okay to be in contact with food? So it's definitely very complex. The government agencies, you know, US FDA, the EU, they have requirements where you basically have to show that your recycling process can remove those contaminants to a level of safety that's basically equivalent to the virgin material.
Okay. So I'm guessing there's kind of two ways to get to that really pure recycled content. One is you're really controlling the feed source, like the source of that material. So if it's really clean, you're good to go. The other way is to have some sort of cleaning process that's going to remove all of different contaminants. And at the end of that, you have to test the material itself, right? To make sure that it's free of all of those.
Yeah, it's typically, so the requirement, the regulatory requirement is basically all of that combined. You typically have to have a dedicated source for your recycled content. It's typically not coming from the curbside because it is just too variable. So you have your dedicated source that you get your recycled content from. You have your process that is able to clean that material that has to be verified by the government agency as well. And then you have, you know, kind of basically then it starts where a normal virgin material would start, where it then goes through the typical compliance testing to make sure that it would function and test the same way that a virgin material would.
I'm just curious from your standpoint and what you're looking at, which is mostly food safety.
Yeah.
Is it worth the risk to use recycled content, or would it just be better for the entire packaging value chain or even consumers to just stick with virgin material?
I think it is worth the risk. I think with the amount of food packaging that we use and how critical it is, you know, that food packaging isn't going anywhere. So I think if we can find a safe way to reuse that, then that's ideal for the environment and, you know, for everybody.
Yeah, I've kind of heard it described as like the more PCR we use in our packaging today, then it'll increase demand and then the market will find ways to be able to collect it and process it. And
yeah,
all the way from, I mean, you kind of mentioned it early on of having a single stream. So being able to have food packaging recycled all together and not have the chance that, you know, some empty oil bottle is going to be chucked in there and, you know, cause a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
So I work a lot with glass packaging in the beauty personal care space, but also a little bit in food and beverage. What's your take on using glass for food packaging?
I mean, glass is great. It's a very inert material, so it's not going to really transfer anything hazardous to the food. I'd say the biggest concern is the transportation of it. You know, it's heavier, it's more likely to break. But in terms of chemical safety, I mean, it's an ideal material, really.
Yeah, I've actually never even been able to really explain why it's such a great, like, it's so, it's just the way that it is. Is it because of?
Yeah, not porous, not.
Yeah, is it just the way that it's manufactured because it's melted down to a certain high degree and then it melts in that way? And
yeah, just based on the material properties itself, it's just from the chemical standpoint, it's a great packaging material.
Yeah, breakage though, that Frank's hot sauce, man, when it falls off the table, it's not a happy day. Yeah.
And especially a global company, you know, when you're transporting things across the world, it's definitely more expensive to do.
And then also with all of, I mean, this is a little outside of kind of your scope, but I know you're aware of it, but you know, all of the companies now have these CO2 goals to like reduce carbon emissions, and manufacturing glass and shipping glass is a higher carbon footprint typically than using plastic packaging.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
So going back to plastics, because it's just fun, what are some of the differences you've kind of seen between using the flexible packaging that we were talking about, those multi-layer, you know, or I guess monomaterial layers, and using rigid packaging in the different formats like PET, PE, polypropylene? You know, have you kind of seen that there are certain plastics that you do not want touching food, and then there are other plastics that maybe are a little bit more effective at that barrier protection?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely depends on, I guess, what the product is and what your goals for the packaging are, you know, how you want it to function. There's certain plastics that are better, you know, more rigid. So you'll use those for something where, you know, if it's a liquid that you want to be able to pour out of a spout that's, you know, built into it, you don't want it to be kind of crumpling under the consumer's hand. So a lot of it has to do with kind of the functionality of it for what plastic you'll choose. But for the most part, I'd say most food packaging is either going to be olefin polymers, so polypropylene, polyethylene, or PET. You know, you don't see a lot of other types of plastics used typically.
Yeah. And is it because those just have the best barrier kind of properties, or is it because the economies of scale for those types of plastic are just really, really high? And so it's a cheaper material, or?
I think it has a lot to do with the, going back to the chemical safety, the monomers used for those, you know, the starting units, the propylene, ethylene, those aren't typically very hazardous monomers on their own. So when you make a plastic resin, you take those monomers, you react them so that they form the polymer chain, which gives you the resin, the plastic. But often you'll have leftover monomers, and that's kind of what one of the concerns is. So like with polystyrene, you'll have leftover styrene, which isn't ideal With polycarbonate, BPA is one of the monomers, so you'll have leftover BPA, or it can degrade back into BPA. So I think it has to do a lot with the resin, those starting substances themselves being typically safer than others.
All right. I got to ask you, but what's a story or example that you have from your work where you were, where it was like, this is not cool. Like, this is not good. There's a ton of plastic migrating into this food and this can't happen.
I gotta think of a good one.
I'll be pumped to hear if it never has happened to you. I'm just curious.
I mean, I'd say most of the time it wasn't anything concerning about like, here's this new product we're packaging we're developing. Can you, you know, look at the compliance of it? Typically, there was nothing like, oh my goodness, this is terrible. That was usually typically straightforward. It would most likely be more of the, you know, back when I was consulting, the post-market incidents or the, I guess, during market incidents of, you know, they would, I think it was like a company that was harvesting potatoes. So it went back even to the food manufacturer.
All right. So they're definitely from Idaho. Got it. Potatoes. Yeah.
So the machinery used to get the potatoes from the field was collecting golf balls. So ultimately, the concern was, you know, they had a consumer who had bought a bag of French fries or something. It's like, there are pieces of plastic in my food here.
Wait. The same machine that was picking up the potatoes was also double working as a golf ball collector?
Well, so people, the fields, you think about the fields, people are just hitting golf balls.
Oh, they're hitting. Okay. All right.
Out into nowhere. So then those golf balls were getting collected by this machine.
Got it. Okay.
They were getting processed with the potatoes and ultimately it ended up in the packaged food. And so the consumer is like, why are there pieces of plastic in here?
Wow.
And so, you know, doing investigations to figure out where that came from. It's like, well, that's a golf ball. It came from the field.
Wow, that's really interesting. I feel a little silly that I was thinking these machines were double dipping in functions.
No, I kind of jumped over the...
No. It was a good clarification. But golfers are out there just hitting golf balls into fields or whatever.
Yeah, you don't really think about the fact that those are going to get harvested with the potatoes.
All right, that's a pretty good one. So we have a lot of like kind of students or people that are interested in kind of working in the field of packaging. And I know you've obviously been well educated in a lot of these different things, but what advice would you have for maybe students that were thinking about getting into packaging?
Yeah, definitely. Because I wish I would have known. I actually went back to my graduate school once I got into food contact. And I was like, since I never knew that this was even a possibility, I feel like, especially in the sciences, you think it's basically you work in a lab. That's basically the career path that you can take. But I think it's so great to know that there are other opportunities. And so I did. I went back to my graduate school and said, like, can I come give a talk and tell people about this type of job and that this is actually a place that you can go into with a science background? Because it's so interesting and it's not going anywhere. If anything, it's becoming more and more important in terms of chemical safety, sustainability, all of those sides of packaging. So just, I'd say a lot of it is focused on the macro side of packaging in terms of, you know, the packaging engineering and the structure and function, but the chemical safety of it is still so important. You know, I mean, that's a huge part of it and evaluating the compliance of it. So just knowing that is still a possibility for a career path is, I think, just vital information to get out there.
Yeah, that there's actually an industry there. Yeah, it's a really cool jobs.
Yeah, and it's a very small world. You know, I mean, I've been in the food contact industry for almost 8 years now. And I just see the same people over and over. So we definitely need more.
Need some young blood.
Yeah.
Not that you're not. All right, Kim. So I know we're running out of time, but I got one more question for you. What's kind of like a common misconception or maybe like a helpful piece of information about like food contact compliance or kind of anything in that area there that you think people should know?
Yeah, definitely. I'd say the biggest thing that I would have to tell clients back when I was consulting was testing does not equal compliance.
How interesting.
So food packaging is very different from other types of packaging where you can make it out of anything. You know, sometimes there's testing to make sure there's no lead or, you know, like if thinking of like children's toys, things like that. But for food packaging, like I said before, there's those positive lists of chemicals. So they can only be manufactured out of those chemicals. You know, you can't just take anything and make a food package. So the composition side of it is unique to food packaging and a critical part of it. So you can't just make a package, test it, and say that it complies. It really starts at the manufacturer of it, the composition. Then there are typically test requirements. And then there's also the good manufacturing practices. So it's basically kind of the three main pillars, the composition, the testing, and the good manufacturing practices. And that's kind of, you know, keeping contamination out throughout the whole supply chain. So not just testing. That was definitely the biggest misconception, is that, you know, hey, can you test this package and tell me if it complies? And that's just simply not how it goes.
That is really good to know. You mentioned the positive list. I'm guessing that there's a pretty significant negative list, and that list is growing. Is that accurate?
Not really. So they typically, the main countries that have established regulations are going to be the US, FDA, EU. China has some well-developed regulations as well that are kind of borrows the US and EU. So the US and EU are the two main ones. They both have the positive list, but there's not typically a negative list, because if it's not on the positive list, it is on the negative list. You know, there's not an established negative list. It's just anything that's not positively listed shouldn't be used or is not allowed to be used.
So what's your take on like the BPA or BPAs and the PFAS that are kind of in a lot of the headlines right now? Like, what's your take on those?
Oh, they're a big pain for sure. But I think for good reason. It's interesting to see the differences in how the EU and the US approach these topics, because the EU takes a very stringent approach that goes, sometimes it feels a little beyond consumer safety, where it's just saying this chemical is bad in any amount, when really, you know, looking at toxicology, there are certain levels where it's not hazardous. You know, I mean, I think one of the other biggest misconceptions is that a chemical is bad, when really it's the chemical has a hazard, but the risk of that also has to do with the exposure. So it's hazard times exposure gives you the risk. And if there's very little exposure, there's very little risk oftentimes. So it's interesting to see how they're kind of going back and forth with how to limit these substances and evaluate the safety of them, because it's definitely complex. But
do you think that the concerns about PFAS in particular, these forever chemicals that are always going to be the environment, are the concerns valid? Are they accurate? Like, should we be taking steps to limit their use and eventually eliminate their use?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think that there is a big hazard associated with those. And because they are so, or were at least, you know, pretty widely used, and they don't go away, they're reoccurring. So the more that we recycle these materials and increase PCR in our packaging, the more PFAS is there, because it's not going anywhere. It's just building up more and more and more. So limiting it, I think, is really critical. But that also gets difficult, because there's not always, it's not like people are just adding PFAS to packaging for fun. You know, it's doing a specific function. So often in food packaging, one of the main uses is in paper packaging. It gives it that grease, oil, and water barrier property. Otherwise, you know, you have a paper cup and your drink will just go right through it. So it's there for a specific reason, and there aren't always a good replacement option. So I think at least limiting it to where it's extremely necessary is important. And, you know, and getting rid of, if there is replacement that's less hazardous, using that, I think for sure.
Yeah, it's probably pretty interesting, like when we start looking at it, just how prevalent, you know, PFAS is in just our daily walk of life. And the way you describe that, I mean, any paper to go, any, you know, anything that's basically helping protect the barrier protection and something that typically wouldn't have it, or nonstick pans, or I mean they're really all over the place. I know in manufactured and packaging, often they're just used as a coating on the outside, so they go through lines a lot quicker.
Yeah.
And they don't get hung up. But
yeah, I think that's what's interesting, is getting that information to consumers, because I think from the outside, it's like, okay, this chemical is bad, stop using it. It's like, well, it's doing a specific function. We're using it for a reason. Not that that makes it okay, but, you know, if that function is needed, you know, for example, like with the paper packaging, getting it, giving that oil and water barrier property, really the only other way currently to do that is by replacing that with a plastic layer on the paper. And then now that isn't recyclable. So it, you know, there is that give and take of all of these different aspects of the life cycle of the packaging that have to be considered.
The complexities of sustainable packaging.
I know.
Man, it's just, it always comes back to, it's complicated.
It is very complex. I think that's something a lot of people don't understand, especially with the food contact side. There is so much to consider. It's a very complex area.
Yeah. Well, Kim, my one question turned into about four, so I'm sorry about that. But
that's what happens.
Thank you so much for being on our show. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah. Enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
All right. Take good care.
You too.
Well, thank you so much for listening to the episode today. And a special thanks to Kim for being on her show and for sharing her story and the history of how she kind of got into the industry and what she loves about it. It's always great to hear from a person who's really passionate about what they do in the packaging world. Until next time, take good care of yourselves. Thanks a lot. Bye.